And tonight, as you can see, and as we have been announcing, we're going to continue to talk about the cults, and in particular, we're going to talk about, as TJ has already said, the Muslim faith. You'll notice that, and I put this up every time, of course, with each of these cults, a number of things that we've noticed. I'll put this up very quickly. We'll focus on number two there especially. Well, one and two, but primarily number two. And we won't get into the other points tonight so much. But tonight we'll be talking about the founder and leader of the religion of Islam, and that is, of course, Muhammad. When we begin to look at the roots of the Muslim religion, I said last time, and let me very briefly run back over just a couple of things. I condensed several charts down to a couple of charts here. But to understand the Muslim religion, I do think it's important, we'll mention this at least one more time tonight, that you gain a working knowledge of the Arabic people. The roots, the origin of the religion of Islam certainly is within those people, and I think we'll see that tonight especially. The religion is both an ethnic as well as a doctrinal one, to be sure. We'll see that also. And yet, while many people equate the Arabic nations with the Muslim religion, that's not quite accurate. And as we said last week, and I may say several times in this study, all Arabs are not Muslims, and all Muslims are certainly not Arabs. Living in this area, we know that. Nonetheless, to better understand the religion, it is rooted in the culture and the history of the Arabic people, and so we want to note that. Very briefly, as we began to look, and if you're looking in your Bibles, you may want to turn a page back or so to Genesis 10. Following the flood, the three sons of Noah began to populate the earth. That is to say, their progeny did. And there was the emergence of what the Bible calls the table of nations or the various nations and so forth. And there was also a general dispersion that went throughout the world, of course, affected by God through the Tower of Babel, because the people weren't doing what God wanted the earth to fill up with people, and they were not doing that. But generally speaking, of the three sons of Noah, the sons of Japheth basically migrated north and west. We'll see this on a map in just a second. The sons of Shem, or Semitic peoples, basically migrated south into what we now call the Arabian Desert. And yet at that time it was probably, well, evidence is showing it really was a very fertile land. Hamitic peoples, or the sons of Ham, generally migrated north along what is called the Fertile Crescent, and then basically southward along the Mediterranean Sea, or the coast of the sea, into Africa. And they also migrated to the Far East, into lands such as China, Mongolia. Now, around 3500 B.C., as climates began to change, and especially as the Arabian area became the Arabian Desert, or began to anyway, Semitic peoples of Arabia very evidently migrated into the valley between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And I want to slow down here for a moment, because I don't think this point can be emphasized enough. When you begin to look at the hatred in this area, you could draw a circle around generally in the Middle East. And you can show through history how Japheth is out of the picture, basically to the north in Europe, and is really out of the picture. But between Ham and Shem and the descendants, one people settles an area, the other comes along and displaces them. And that just keeps going in a violent circle. And I'll show that in just a moment on a map. But it leads to a lot of the hostility that you see today. It certainly plays into it. It's fed by the religion, of course, but it is not purely a religious hostility. In that environment, though, of now Semitic Sumer, of course it was Hamitic at one time, but Semitic Sumer, in the city-state of Ur, Abraham was born, and he was called by God, of course, and made his way across the Fertile Crescent. Now, let me kind of summarize this with a map. You see Japheth migrating to the north and the west. You see Ham migrating to the west, to the far east, down into Africa. And you see Shem, and of course first down into that fertile area, but now back up into the valley between the Tigris and Euphrates. Modern day Iraq would be the area, Kuwait and Iraq. Now we look at Abraham. Abraham is called from Ur, travels up to Haran, and then down into Shechem, and settles there. And now he is in the land of Canaan. Now if we stop for a moment and just view that map, what do you have? Well, Ham has been displaced, as it were, by Shem. Certainly with the descendants of Abraham taking over the land of Canaan, now you have Semites who have taken notice, who have taken not only the Hamitic area of Kuwait, Iraq, that area, but have now displaced the descendants of Ham, the original Canaanites, have displaced them from Canaan. There's a long time hatred that exists between these people. Not all these people are gone. The Philistines are still there, etc., and they're descendants of Ham. But now Abraham's descendants, through Isaac, have taken over Canaan, and so you have Semites that have displaced Hamites in both these areas. And it gets worse, because Abraham not only has Isaac, and he is Semitic, but remember he has other children. He has Ishmael by Hagar, and he would be half Semite, half Hamite, as it were. And really the nature and so forth he takes on is his mother's, because obviously Hagar is driven out of that area. And if you're looking on the map and you see that big beige area of the Arabian Desert, Ishmael goes back into that area. Again, back into the area once occupied by Semites, now reoccupied by Hamites, as it were, our Hamitic people. There will be other sons of Abraham, and these sons will settle that same beige area, and again, they are Hamitic. So again, a violent circle of Semites displacing Hamites who displace Semites and so forth, and all of this goes on over the course of about 2,500 years, well before any of the struggles that we see religiously that began with, obviously, the descendants of Abraham. So it's a very interesting situation going on in that, again, that circle that you could draw on the map there. Now, according to the Quran, Abraham, because the ancestor of the Muslims, we look at him as the ancestor of the Jews, and by faith, the ancestor of Christians. But we should understand that according to the Quran, he's also the ancestor of the Muslims by covenant. They refer to themselves as the nation of Abraham. They refer to their religion as the religion of Abraham. That began with Muhammad. It continues to this day because the Quran numerous times refers to the religion as such. Muslims believe Muhammad is a descendant of Ishmael. Not a lot of reason to doubt that. They also cite the sons of Keturah, and they, those sons of Keturah, together with the descendants of Esau and Ishmael, notice, all descendants of Abraham, they populate and become the direct ancestors of these various Arab nations, all of them now occupying all of what we would call today Saudi Arabia. They'll migrate further, they'll extend further, but at this time in our history as we're looking at it, throughout what we call Saudi Arabia, or the Arabian Desert. Now, in the centuries that followed, let's deal for a moment with the Old Testament and Isaac's descendants. Obviously, they populated Canaan, but that wasn't the end of it, was it? It gets worse, right, as far as an ethnic migration. Because of the captivities of the Assyrians in 722, or the Babylonians in 606, and the domination and removal of people for slavery, etc., by the Grecians and Romans post-4th century B.C., they were dispersed throughout the Middle East. Again, what do you have? Well, you have Semitic descendants of Abraham through Isaac now going back into those same lands that they left, reoccupying those lands, maintaining their identity of Abraham and Isaac, or the Jewish religion, very strongly so, maintaining their identity, yet living in those areas and becoming a constant struggle, as far as it is, culturally, because they do not assimilate into the Arabic or the Hamitic or whatever cultures of those nations, they maintain that Jewish identity. And so again, leading to a hundreds growing into now a 1,500-year struggle in that area by the time you come to Muhammad. So in Acts 2, if we were to come to the first century and the New Testament, what do you have in Acts 2? Well, look at Acts chapter 2 and look about beginning about verse 8 when they hear the apostles preaching, every one of them in the language, notice, in which we were born. And then it begins to list a number of nations. You have over 15 nations mentioned in which the Jews have been scattered. That Parthians and Medes and Elamites and dwellers in Mesopotamia, etc., etc., you can see there. A number of these people had moved into Arabic lands, especially if you're looking there at, again, dwellers in Mesopotamia, Elamites, Parthians, Medes, etc. Those are all Arabic lands. And those lands had received an influx of Arabic peoples, again, coming out of those desert areas, those descendants of Esau, Ishmael, and the sons of Keturah, etc., into these lands to the north and east. So they're clashing. And to get even worse, obviously, if one takes a look at it after the day of Pentecost, again, what do you have? You've got Arabic people with their idolatry. You've got Jewish people maintaining their identity. And throughout the Middle East, you've got a number of people that are converted to Christianity. So if a person takes a look at what happens in the years from the first century to basically the 6th century A.D., following the destruction of Jerusalem, especially when more Jews are dispersed throughout these areas, one can see that in the first several centuries after the coming of Christ, you have a very competitive religious environment, if not ethnic, and there is, but a religious environment in which you have Jews, Christians, and Arabs all struggling with one another and all laying claim, both by right of religion. Christianity is the supreme religion of the world. Judaism is the supreme religion of the world. Arabs were here first. And you get all of that in all of these lands, all laying claim to the lands from an ethnic as well as religious right. Now, if we just stop right there, that's enough. I mean, again, where did we start? Basically, 3500 B.C., this is a 3,500-year mess just right there. If we just stop right there and we didn't add the Muslim religion into the mix, if that wasn't even considered, that would be a mess that could easily lead to the struggles and the civil wars and everything else you had in those areas, even to this present day. If we just had that. But you're going to add the Muslim religion, so there is no wonder why you have all that goes on in that area constantly, the hot, heated battles that go on and never seem to end, and never will, both by biblical claim as well as just a person taking a look at, you know, pragmatically speaking, what is naturally going to be the case. Now, as we look at it, it's into this environment, then, in the 6th century, that Muhammad, and I'm going to call him Muhammad, I'm going to spell his name that way, you'll variously see it Muhammad and Mohammed, but Muhammad, the undisputed founder and spiritual leader of Islam, was born in Mecca, what's now Saudi Arabia, and I'll show it on a map in a moment. In AD 570, he was born into the Quraysh tribe, which was a leading tribe of Arabs at the time, and they were descendants of Ishmael. Now, just very brief history of his childhood. His father, Abdullah, died before he was even born. His mother died when he was 6 years old. It made him an orphan, obviously. He was brought up by his grandfather. I was brought up by my grandmother to a great degree, but he was brought up by his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, in his first few years. But his grandfather then died, and he was finally taken into the home of his uncle, Abu Talib, who was a nomadic caravan trader roaming as far as Syria. And that's important, because that highly influences Muhammad's life. If you look on a map and you see Syria is a considerable distance away, and when we're talking about Syria, we're talking about, biblically, we would be looking at the cities of Antioch, Damascus, etc. It's quite a distance away. It would carry him through Israel, which is the best pass. Trading route. A lot of you that we studied downstairs, you know, that's the trade route, ran right through Israel. It would take him through those lands all through his childhood. He would meet those people. He would come to know those cultures. And he would move into what we would call Iran, Iraq. He would trade into that area as far down as into Africa and Egypt and Ethiopia. So quite a distance. I mean, those caravans roam all over the place, or did, I guess still do some of them, but roaming all over the place throughout the Middle East. It's important because it highly influenced him. Now, if you're looking on a map, Mecca, and the arrow is pointing to Mecca. I don't know how well you can see that or not, but I wanted to get the whole area in view. Mecca is right there in what it would be the right on the coast, almost, of the Red Sea, right at the bottom of Saudi Arabia there. And that's the city into which he is born, and Mecca becomes obviously the most important city of his life. And we're going to talk about Mecca quite a bit. But that is the land, obviously, of Muhammad. Now, as we continue to look at his life, during his travels with his uncle, Muhammad obviously met members of the Jews, Christians, other religions, and there were a number of other religions that had cropped up within the first 600 years after Christ. But a number of religions, and all of whom apparently influenced him. He seems to draw upon any and all of these religions. We could get deeply into that. I will somewhat get into it when we look at the various beliefs of the Muslim faith. But he seems to draw upon beliefs of all of the various religions. After learning his uncle's trade, he began to work for a wealthy widow named Khadija. And Khadija really is an important figure in his life for several reasons. He gained her confidence and respect, eventually ended up managing her caravans. She was quite wealthy. And at the age of 25, Muhammad married her. She was a widow. You'll notice 15 years his senior. He's 25, she's 40. There's an interesting study that is done of Muhammad and Khadija, and really Khadija becomes almost a mother figure to him, as much as a wife to him. And that's important in his life. But he's 25, he marries her at 40. It also provides him with wealth and success, and maybe is as important as anything, it gives him time for his religious reflection, as it's sometimes referred to. But basically what this amounts to is Muhammad will spend a long time, about 15 years, going off into seclusion, doing a lot of meditating, thinking, reflecting, whatever you want to call it. But it's probably during this time that a lot of these beliefs are formulated. And he has the time to do that because Khadija has provided him the wealth and the freedom in order to do that. And it's important to note that she encouraged it. Apparently she was all for his excursions off into meditation and so forth. He spent much of his time in the seclusion of the desert meditating and reflecting on his life and the present spiritual environment, and there's quite a study that goes on about all of that. I'm not going to get too deeply into it, because I'm more concerned with what grows out of it than what was happening during that 15 years. But it is an interesting study in itself. Now, Muhammad and Khadija apparently enjoyed a good marriage. There isn't any discussion or anything about troubles between them. They enjoyed each other until she died at the age of about 66. Notice she's older than him. So about 26 years later, she dies. He is still, notice, he would only be about 50, 51 years old. So he's still relatively young, and she dies. Now during that time, he developed, obviously, a passionate monotheistic belief. Christianity's influenced him, Judaism's influenced him, etc. And his own people are very idolatrous, and they believe in a pantheon of gods, numerous gods. Think about what the Bible teaches of Abraham's people. Remember Jacob going back into the land of Mesopotamia and working for his uncle Laban? And Laban had all of those gods. Remember Rachel stole those when they left to go back home? Well, that idolatry was maintained throughout all those years. And there are a lot of people that held on to that. As you look at other situations in the Old Testament and so forth, Joshua discusses how that Abraham's ancestors, our fathers beyond the great river Euphrates, were very idolatrous, served other gods, but Abraham had faith in the one God. Now, all of that comes together, and Muhammad is reflecting on all of that. He's thinking, and remember, he's a descendant of Abraham as well. So he's reflecting on all of that, and all of that is influencing Muhammad. He's met Jews, he's met Christians, there's all of that idolatry going on. There's all the superstitions as well, ridiculous superstitions that these people believed in. And he just, you know, he absolutely objects to all that, refuses all of that. In Mecca, to show you, and of course to bring us to talking about probably the most important idolatrous building and place in Islam and in Muhammad's life, in Mecca there was a cube-shaped building. It isn't a large, grand thing. It wasn't in his life. Called Kaaba. Now some of you may be familiar with this, some of you may not. The Quraysh tribe of Arabs guarded this shrine in whose walls was embedded this ancient black stone. Now just think for a moment. Here's this building, and in the very walls of this building, this shrine, there is this black stone. All right, what in the world is that? Well, as you're going to look at this thing, ancient legend claims this black stone had fallen from heaven during the time of Adam. I doubt that, seriously. Remember, the world is destroyed by the flood in between Adam and Muhammad. But they claim that it had fallen during the time of Adam. It's a possible indication that this thing was a meteorite, and really when you look at it in a moment, it really looks like a meteorite. So that's what I suppose it probably is. But supposedly from heaven in the time of Adam. Now, according to the Quran, the first shrine on the site was built by Adam in Mecca. It was supposed to be the very first building ever built on earth. And supposedly the Kaaba reflects this house in heaven that they call, this holy temple in heaven that they call Al-Baitu-i-Ma'mur. Now, as you go on to study about this thing, Muslims believe that it was on a pilgrimage to Mecca that Abraham, or as they call him, Ibrahim, and his son Ismail, or Ishmael, had rebuilt Kaaba on the old foundations of Adam's shrine and positioned this black stone within its walls. Now, let me tie all of this together. So what do you have? Well, you got this building. In his home city of Mecca, you've got this shrine, this little building. And in its walls, there is this mysterious black stone. And there's a legend that surrounds it. They say this stone fell from heaven, or was given from heaven by the angels to Adam. And that Adam built a shrine, a holy place, to house this stone. And that it had fallen into disarray, but that Abraham and Ishmael had come back to Mecca and rebuilt. Remember, Abraham, the father of Ishmael, he reunited with Ishmael, according to the Muslims. He reunited with Ishmael, and the two of them together had the true faith. Isaac is considered to go off into a heretic faith. But Abraham and Ishmael have the true faith, and they rebuild on the foundations of Adam's shrine, this shrine housing the black stone, and that becomes a shrine, now notice the point, a shrine to the true God, the God of Abraham, not yet named, certainly not the God of the Jews in the Bible, and certainly not Jesus Christ, but the true God, as yet unnamed. The stone is supposed to be a stone from paradise that's sent to the angels by Abraham, or Abraham. And by around AD 500, this stone had come to be viewed as a very link between heaven and earth. And so there's all of this superstition and so forth that surrounds this thing. The shrine figured prominently in Muhammad's life, and it will figure prominently in the establishment and development, obviously, of Islam. Now let's take a look at it. Here's the actual stone. As far as I know, it's the very stone that Muhammad had his hands on in the 6th century A.D. Obviously, it's been surrounded and encased in this whatever that is. I'm not sure what that thing is. And that gives you another view of what it looks like. And you can see about the size of it. And if you've ever watched any of these science programs on TV and whatever, it really does look like one of these meteorites that people find from time to time. And there is Kaaba. Give you a couple of views of it. That's what it looks like from a distance when it's filled up with people in Mecca. And on the left there is an indication of the size of it. You see people standing around. It's not a gigantic place. but on the right, and of course that would be the modern version of it, obviously. Shrouded in mystery and superstition. Let's continue to talk about what happened with Muhammad, though. Shrouded in mystery and superstition since antiquity, this actual stone, about a foot in diameter, 30 centimeters, its shrine had come to be the center of, notice, idolatry in ancient Mecca. And that's important. His people were idolaters. His people served or worshipped all kinds of gods. But there was one in particular that Muhammad focused on. Pre-Islamic Mecca served as a peaceful refuge for warring Arabic tribes. They were always fighting, but one time during the year, they all seemed to make this annual pilgrimage to this Kaaba, to this black stone, and in which was housed the chief deity of the ruling Quraysh tribe, which is Allah. Now, Allah is an idolatrous god at this time. He's what the Arabs called, it was the name they had for their creator deity. Now you have to think the way Muhammad is thinking. Here they're serving all these false gods. But I believe, and I've come to believe, in the one God that Abraham believed in. Not Jehovah, not the God of the Jews, but there was a one God that Abraham believed in. And I believe that Abraham and Ishmael erected a shrine to Allah, and what has happened is, over the course of 2,500 years, my people, who have always been idolatrous, they were idolatrous in Abraham's day when he left the area, and they're idolatrous now, my people have turned Abraham's shrine to the one God into an idolatrous temple. And he began to formulate in his mind the idea that it needed to be restored to the one true God, whom he named Allah. He took the name of the creator deity, the idol that the shrine was at the present time dedicated to, and he took Allah as a name for the creator God of Abraham and set about to restore what he considered to be the true religion of Abraham and Ishmael. And that's really the beginning. That's the foundations of the religion. He would later take Allah to be the one God of Abraham and the prophets. He disassociated himself, obviously, from the idolatrous practices that his people had and he'd have been associated with early in life. He became acquainted with a group of people in Mecca who called themselves the Hunafa, those who turn away. They were opposed to the idolatry and the meeting and worshiping at the Kaaba, you know, and worshiping this black stone and all of those practices that went on. They claimed to be seeking the truth, just like him. And that's not surprising. I mean, anytime you have someone looking for the truth, chances are great you're going to look around you, and if you begin to talk and discuss, you're going to find other people. He found there were a group of people who were seeking truth, and they called themselves the Hanafa. Muhammad regularly, during this time, would take the month of Ramadan. I'm sure everybody here is familiar with Ramadan and what the Islamic faith does with Ramadan. Where did all that come from? Well, Ramadan was a real month. It was the name of a month just like we have January. It was the name of the Arabic calendar, a month of the calendar. And he would take this month. He'd take it off every year, like people vacation. But he would take this year off, or this month off every year, and with his family, he would go into the mountains outside of Mecca. Obviously, it's cooler there and all of this kind of thing. And during this time, he would withdraw into a cave and meditate. I don't know what his family was doing, but that's basically the way he would spend his month, is meditating during Ramadan. Now, it was there at the age of 40, during one of these Ramadan meditations, that he supposedly began to receive revelations from Allah through the angel Gabriel. This is where everything begins to change. A lot of things changed for him about this time. There's all kinds of supposition as far as what happened to him. I've got my own ideas, and some of you are aware of what I think happened to him. But what happened to him is he began to suffer through some things, and what he said was happening, what he came to say was happening, is that he was receiving revelations from Allah through Gabriel. Now, this is how it would go down, and this is the way he describes it. These encounters were supposedly very violent. When we look at Gabriel, for example, visiting Zechariah or Joseph or Daniel, I mean, it's a very peaceful, loving angel that we see. But apparently with Muhammad, Gabriel beat him up. Gabriel came to him, was very violent with him, ordered him, demanded that he submit to God's truth. He describes it, for example, in Surah 96, or chapter 96 of the Quran. And it was in these violent encounters with Gabriel that he was forced into submission to Allah. Now think about it. That in itself colors the whole philosophy of Islam. If the prophet of God that restored the truth submitted to Allah by violence, what does that tell you? What is that tone does that set for all the future of the religion? But yeah, that's what he describes happened. He goes on to say the encounters were both violent and accompanied by convulsions, which sent him into an unconscious trance. He feared, he said originally, that he was possessed by one of the jinn or demons that commonly inhabited Arabian poets and soothsayers. But in fact, he went on to conclude, and as you can see, let me jump ahead a point and come back to that. Khadijah and others convinced him that in fact it was from God that he was getting these visions that he was having and these violent fits, that it was coming at the hands of Gabriel, and reassured Muhammad. A lot of people have looked at what he describes and concluded that really what he's describing is that he was going through epileptic seizures. That he suffered from epilepsy. He wouldn't have known what it is. But he was suffering from epilepsy, brought on perhaps by some of the conditions during this time of reflection and meditation, and that he was ended up having these epileptic seizures. He didn't know what was going on. But in the religious state he was in, he turned it around into being a time in which he was getting all of these visions. He used it, is the point. And he used it well. He came off with having doubts. He allowed other people to reassure him. It literally was coming from God. And he came out of this thing. You think about it. For hundreds of years, people that had epilepsy were stuck off somewhere. They were quarantined. They were shunned by society. People didn't understand it. And here is a guy that was able to use it, apparently, to become a leader of one of the largest religions in the world. That's a pretty amazing feat. But he accomplished that. Convinced that he, in fact, had been called by Allah as Allah's prophet, his revelations started occurring with greater frequency, obviously, and he began relating them to others, and he was gaining followers. And every time he would go out, and I've read descriptions of this, every time he would go out and apparently have one of these, what looks like an epileptic fit, people began to get excited. Because as they watched him out there writhing around in the desert sand and so forth, they're thinking, well, Allah's giving him another vision, and he's going to tell us more. And so more and more people were attracted to this, which is, I know it's kind of strange to us, but maybe in that environment it's not so strange with all of their superstition and so forth that they had. Within 3 years, about AD 622, Muhammad had started publicly preaching these revelations. Themes like this. Allah is one. Again, think in terms of all that idolatry, all that pantheon of gods, now one God. Allah is one. And that complete submission, the word Islam means submission, complete submission to Him is the only acceptable way to worship Allah. And that He Himself, Muhammad, was Allah's prophet and messenger. In the same vein as other great Islamic prophets, we'll get into this next week, but prophets like Abraham, whom he claimed was an Islamic prophet long before the religion of Islam. He was simply restoring, you see, or you understand. This wasn't something new, it was a restoration. So in the same vein as these other great Islamic prophets that had come before, he was Allah's last great prophet. He gained followers from the beginning, but he also met with a lot of resistance, no doubt. And while receiving his revelations, his teaching was focused on opposing the idolatry of the majority of the population of Mecca. Now, obviously, the majority of the population of Mecca doesn't want to change their religion. They're happy with all their idolatry, and they're happy with Kaaba and the black stone and, you know, all of that kind of thing. They're happy with it. And they don't want to change it. And now Muhammad is teaching them all of this stuff and saying Gabriel has ordered him to accept it and all of that kind of thing. Most people aren't going to go for it, but some did. So as he gains followers and so forth, he begins also to be tolerant of other monotheistic religions. Remember, in the area, you don't just have Arabs and idolatrous Arabs. You also have those Muhammad called the people of the book. You have Jews and you have Christians, people of the book, people of the Bible. And he was tolerant of these people in the beginning because they served and believed in one God as opposed to the many. But after he goes to Medina, as we'll see, and after he builds up his following, his attitude and his teaching will change toward them. Obviously, I'll come back to that. Hostility, though, from the Meccan tribes began to intensify toward Muhammad very quickly and his Hunafa, his seekers. And to escape persecution, he sent some of them to Abyssinia, which is Ethiopia, Africa. And the rest of them had to leave Mecca because of the outcry against them. And obviously, they will end up in Medina, then called Yathrib, about 280 miles north of Mecca. This is, of course, in the year 622. That event, very important, this term is called by Muslims the Hijra, and it's very important. It's a very important time. It's like New Year's. It's like the beginning. It marks the beginning of the Islamic year, and it's considered the very beginning of the religion of Islam. So this flight from Mecca, and sometimes you hear it put like that, the flight from Mecca is the beginning of the Muslim religion, officially, as most people mark it. In Medina, Muhammad united the conflicting nomadic Arab tribes with about 8 years of war. He fought them, he subdued them, and by 630, he had an army of about 10,000. And I'll call it an army because that's really what it is. You can call it followers of his faith, and they were. But really, as much as anything, they're an army. And they're 8 years battle-hardened, and they're good. No question about it. It's a very effective army as time goes on. He was given supreme authority, believed by these people to be God's spokesman, etc. So he had a supreme authority, proclaimed himself to be the last of the prophets. His message was the last revelation from Allah, and they accepted that. Now, if you're looking on this map, again, Abyssinia there, Ethiopia, and the flight up to Medina. Mecca and Medina become very important in the Islamic faith. Muhammad set his attention back on Mecca. Now he has an army of 10,000 people. He's not the guy with the few Hunafa that are kicked out of Mecca any longer. He's a leader of an army of 10,000 battle-hardened troops. And they've won battle after battle after battle. So he turns his attention back on Mecca, which is the center of the Islamic religion because of the revelations that he got there. His interest in Mecca necessitated, I mean, think of the shrine, Abraham and Ishmael, etc. It necessitated his purging the town of the idolatry and bringing it back in harmony with the monotheism, the one God of Islam. He led a series of armed raids in AD 630 on Mecca, and it didn't take him long. He either expelled or slaughtered anyone who opposed him, and at the point of the sword, those that remained behind submitted to Islam. He rededicated the black stone, literally, took it by the hands and rededicated it himself as God's prophet. He rededicated the Kaaba shrine to Allah, but not Allah the idol God, Allah the supreme one God of Abraham. He made it the most sacred site in Islam. And he established Mecca as the holy city. And there is a relief, an ancient relief of Muhammad, obviously, after his death. That's not, probably not what he really looked like. But Muhammad rededicating the black stone to Allah. And then again, as you can see, the Kaaba shrine that now becomes the Muslim temple for all practical purposes. By AD 630, Muhammad had become the most powerful leader in the Arab world, unlike really what those people had ever seen among those nomadic tribes. They'd never seen unification like that until that time. He built up a large army, and he set out to destroy or convert everybody, whole world over. that didn't believe in his doctrine of Islam. That was his intention. He led about 20 campaigns into Arab lands, compelled them to become Muslims by the edge of the sword. There's no telling how far he would have gotten. I mean, he was successful. He was meeting with little resistance. The army was growing. It was very much like, this part of his life is very much like Alexander the Great, if you read about it. But I won't get into that very deeply. His attitude also worsened toward people of the book. He became far less tolerant toward Jews and Christians. Obviously, they're now considered to be not fellow believers in the one God, but heretics. The Muslim religion was founded upon and grew by intimidation, coercion, and terror. And there was a reign of terror under Muhammad for 2 years. Like I said, there's no telling how far he would have gotten, but the dude died. Within 2 years after retaking Mecca, on June the 8th, 632, at the age of 63, he died after returning to Medina from what is now known as his farewell pilgrimage. And by the time of his death, most of the Arabian, Saudi Arabia as we know it today, the Arabian Peninsula had submitted to Islam, and he had united these nomadic tribes into a single Muslim nation, a religious nation, interestingly enough. The Dome of the Rock, why is that thing so important? We're going to mention it for the first time tonight, and I'll close with this. The Dome of the Rock Mosque in Jerusalem is said to enshrine the place from which Muhammad ascended into heaven. Supposedly, earlier in his life, and I don't want to get all into this, but on one of these quests for knowledge, Gabriel had transported him to the place where Abraham was supposed to have sacrificed Isaac, etc., Mount Moriah. He transported him to that rock, and it became a holy place. And then when Muhammad died, he went, again, he was transported to the Dome of the Rock, or to the rock, rather. He was transported to the rock and ascended like Jesus. If you read it, it's described as like Jesus' ascension. He ascended like Jesus into heaven, and he was accompanied by the angel Gabriel. Just like Jesus was accompanied by two angels in Acts chapter 1, Muhammad supposedly was accompanied by Gabriel into heaven. That's why that thing is so sacred to them to this day. And the idea that somebody, care who they are, from America or anywhere else, is going to go over there and get the Palestinians to agree to give up the Dome of the Rock to the Jews. Or on the other hand, if it's where Abraham sacrificed Isaac to get the Jews to give it up to the heretic Muslims, it ain't going to happen. They're going to fight about it probably for as long as time goes on. To give you an idea of the Dome of the Rock, there's the rock. You can see the building around it. And there's the very famous and well-known, we see it in the news probably every week, the Dome of the Rock. And we'll stop there, and we'll come back to the Muslim faith after Muhammad, when it really starts to get interesting. If you're here tonight and you've listened to this lesson, you're thinking, man, I look at this, I see what happens in the life of somebody, okay, I can understand some things that happen, but we're talking about 1.5 billion people in the world, nearly a fourth of the world's population that accept this and believe it. Why do people accept that and refuse to accept the truth? And that's a very soul-searching question. It's a question I think you need to explore. It's a question even I'd like to talk about a little bit Wednesday night in our adult class as we think about the fulfillment of what God said, what God promised in Genesis 12. Maybe it makes us think in a little different terms of when God said to Abraham, I'll make you a great nation, and it will affect, one way or another, all the families of the earth. Maybe that has to do with it. Maybe it has to do with something inside man that makes him want to be religious and search for the truth. And when he looks around him and he sees what's in his life, he's not satisfied with it, and he starts looking for something else. Maybe that's part of it. But for whatever reason, there are people that are still looking. And there are people that are still seeking to know the real truth. And many of them are accepting this story and this supposed truth. You and I know that we have the truth of the Son of God. We have the truth to offer people.
And that's what we need to hand when people come looking.